Mr. George is Chief of Engineering, U.S. Army Engineer District, Alaska, Anchorage. He's graduated with honors with a B.S. in Civil Engineering from Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, and is a registered engineer. He holds a Bachelor of Laws degree and is a member of the bar. Has had extensive consulting experience and background prior to entry into federal service, just prior to World War II, in which he served as an officer for 4 years, with assignments in the Syracuse, Manhattan districts, and overseas in the China, Burma, India theater in the capacities of district engineer and commanding officer of the 330th Engineer Regiment. He resides with his wife, Jeanette, of Neenah, Wisconsin, and his six children in Anchorage, Alaska, Mr. Warren George.
Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, don't be alarmed by this specimen. It's just off the press. I want you to see the tremendous volume of work that was entailed in this investigation of the slide areas of Alaska. It's all condensed information. It will be available for people that have a real interest in it sometime after it has been further reviewed by people that must do this. And I believe they'll probably, because of the expense of the reproduction, probably be a slight charge, but it is such a wealth of information that anyone in the professional field that is interested in soils investigation, I feel would like to know about it. There has been a great deal of talk on the earthquake and the slides, and there is bound to be some repetition. Please excuse this. Those of us that are giving these papers did not have the opportunity to correlate our particular presentations. I'm going to run through what I feel is about as quick a summary of the activities of the Alaska District in the investigation of the slides. And then I have a carousel of 35 millimeter color slides, which aren't integrated into the talk, but which I feel those of you that have not seen the physical destruction that occurred will leave with a better viewpoint on this destruction by having seen them. There have already been shown some excellent slides, and some of these may be repetitious again. Please bear with us on this. To explain the Good Friday, March 27, 1964 earthquake and the slides that it precipitated in the Anchorage area, in the brief time allotted for such presentation at this conference limits the detail of coverage. Some of the more important facts and investigation procedures that were used in obtaining basic data in the analysis undertaken to determine the slide mechanism and the conclusions reached follow. Much effort in programming, mobilizing, planning, exploring, and testing in the execution of the extensive investigation was required. Additional work still is indicated in considerable continued analysis and sifting of the large amount of data obtained before all the facts can be fully evaluated. The quake which triggered the slides took place at 5:36 p.m. on Good Friday, 27 March. Its Richter scale magnitude has been reported as ranging from 8.4 to 8.6 or more. Its duration, while not accurately fixed, is believed by best available evidence as somewhat in excess of 4 minutes and possibly as high as 5 minutes. Data concerning the acceleration and other characteristics associated with the disturbance are not complete or firm. Instrumentation in the form of local strong motion seismic instruments did not exist in the Anchorage area. They do now. The quake has been estimated to have released about twice the energy of the 1906 San Francisco earthquake, or as measured by this nuclear age, the energy equivalent of 2,000 of the largest of the megaton bombs exploded to date. It caused damage which has been placed at from $400 million to $750 million and the loss of life of 114 people. The late hour of the day and the fact that a holiday for many people was involved were factors in keeping the death toll from reaching a much higher figure. Schools were out, people were generally at home or en route back to their residences. Minimizing the damage to the affected coastal communities was the fact that the tides were at the lower stages. These and other fortunate circumstances all seemed to combine to limit damage and death toll from the destruction wrought by the quake destruction of structures and the seismic generated waves that followed the shock. As an example, while the water level from the Tsunami in Belize and Seward reached well into the towns and had disastrous effects on tankage and waterfront docks, harbor works, boats, and other structures, had the tide been at high flood stage, a much greater depth of inundation would have occurred. Just how much additional destruction and loss of life would have resulted is difficult to estimate, but we know it would have been large. The quake caused large changes in level of land masses within the affected areas. In the region west of the Hinge Zone, which generally covers the Anchorage, Kenai, and Kodiak areas, according to tidal readings, the land did subside up to 7.5 feet. And in the region to the east of the Hinge Zone, the land rose as much as 6 feet. Only an approximation of level changes of the large land mass lying near the coast are now accurately available. The intensive survey work will need to be accomplished to define the full scope of these changes and the effect on the land mass further inward. It is known, however, that at one point on Montague Island, a change upward of 33 feet has been noted. That's been in this meeting revised to, I think, somewhere in the 40-foot position. These facts do, however, give a measure of the magnitude of the tremendous forces at work. This disaster and the large amount of intelligence that can be developed from it have had immediate recognition by large and important segments of scientific and professional groups both in and out of the government. Much activity in analytical study and implementation of facts developed is certain to follow. A quake of such intensity and duration hitting the heavily populated and developed West Coast areas could have tremendous disastrous results. It seems to us that a particular need exists in accumulation and analysis of seismic disturbances and their effects on a worldwide basis. While certain areas of the world and the United States are subject to more frequent quakes than others, a look at a map showing known disturbances will show that no area can feel secure. The U.S. Army Engineer District, Alaska, known commonly as the Corps of Engineers, was designated by the Office of Emergency Planning to undertake the rehabilitation work for all public properties that came under OEP responsibilities. One segment of the implementation of this work covered the investigation of the large slides in the Anchorage area. The district sought and secured a broad cross-section of professional help to supplement its own soils and geology and exploration staff in this investigation. From the several competent engineering firms engaged in this field, negotiations resulted in the services of Shannon and Wilson Incorporated, Soils Mechanics and Foundation Consultants of Seattle, Washington. Associated with Shannon and Wilson on this work, among others, were Dr. Harry Seed, Professor of Civil Engineering, University of California, Berkeley, Dr. Neil Talker, Consultant Soil Geologist and Engineer of Seattle, Washington, Dr. Richard H. Meese, Professor of Civil Engineering, University of Washington, and in further consultation, direct to the Anchorage, Alaska District on this work, were Dr. Ralph Peck, Professor of Foundation Engineering of the University of Illinois, Dr. Lawrence Burham, Director of the Norwegian Geotechnical Institute of Oslo, Norway, and Mr. Thomas Thompson, Consulting Geologist of Burlingame, California. Working closely with the operation was a group of foundation soils, geology, and structural men assembled from government agencies known as Task Force 9, headed up in the field by Dr. Edwin Echo of the USGS, and in the Washington area by Mr. William Sham, who you will hear from shortly. So it is evident that considerable talent was available for the study and determinations of the input for field investigations and laboratory analysis work required. There were five major slides and a number of minor ones in the Anchorage area. Each major slide was studied by means of a drilling technique, which resulted in a series of exploration holes placed along predetermined lines cutting across the slides. From this work, profiles of the soil strata were developed. In general, two or more profiles were obtained on each slide. Along each of the profiles, piezometer apparatus of the Casa Grande or GNR type were installed to determine pore pressures. These have been read on a scheduled basis. Slope indicator apparatus has also been installed in the holes to secure knowledge of any subsequent ground movement. The drilling generally of rotary type was of NX and 5-inch sizes, and included mostly Mayhew and Failing type rigs. A Bucyrus Erie churn drill was also used in the investigation. These drill rigs at the height of the drilling totaled 17 in number, to give you an idea of the amount of work. Some were on a double shift basis. In addition, two bucket type augers were used to develop 33 and 42 inch open wells in which actual visual inspection of the layered material could be observed and from which undisturbed samples could be obtained. These latter mentioned operations, although costly items, gave much evidence of subsurface conditions. Drilling operations were carried on over a period of more than two months' duration. In addition to the drilling operations, a deep trench was cut through one slide from which changes from original ground layering were developed. This information and its unique contribution to the analysis is illustrated by one of the exhibits shown here. They're on the board, they're on the wall at this end. They're extremely interesting. I think they're almost self-explanatory. There were approximately 234 holes of one type or another involved in this operation. Continuous samples were taken with Shelby tubes for classification and test specimen purposes. A large number of laboratory tests were scheduled and made. These break down into two general categories: classification and strength tests, and dynamic strength tests. included are visual samples and classification, sampling and classifying water content at berg limits, unconfined compression, vein shear, quick triaxial compression, quick consolidated triaxial compression, consolidation tests, specific gravities, grain size gradations, unit weight determinations, and special dynamic shear strength tests. Approximately 1,700 tests in all were performed. These required from maybe an hour to many hours in laboratory analysis. In order to obtain minimally undisturbed samples, holes were drilled as pairs so that each Shelby tube sample could be taken from an alternate layer and thus prevent distortion or disturbance of the material. Correlation techniques were used to reduce the number of such dual holes in the second profile for any slide. In addition to the tests described above, special dynamic type tests were designed to attempt to analyze dynamic effects of seismic shock on the sand, silt, and clay layers. The results of some of these tests were of considerable help and much interest, and disclosed that the clays were very sensitive in certain layers, and that the sand layers in areas were subject to quick condition developing. Test procedures included a triaxial compression test in which a pulsating deviator stress and a repetitive stress reversal was applied. The test was designed to simulate the action of earthquake shock waves on the soil. It is planned to run plane strain tests in which repetitive stress reversal is also used. Geophysical seismic refraction tests were run on one major slide to determine the limits of soil disturbance and did disclose some interesting information. All slides, except possibly one, were analyzed as horizontal type as contrasted with the more normally thought of circular type failures. Actual land movements varied considerably from 19 to 14 feet horizontally in the 4th Avenue and LK slides to as much as 600 to 1,200 feet in the Turnagain slides, depending on which Turnagain slide you're talking about. Graben-type land subsidence of a serious nature developed in the 4th Avenue and in the LK slides, and an equally damaging multiple series of grabens developed in the Turnagain slide. These, again, can be shown by this cut trench exhibit. The zone of failure, as determined from the field investigations, varied in depth. These have been estimated as being about elevation plus 45, mean sea level for the 4th Avenue slide, at about plus 40 above mean sea level in the central area of the quite complicated LK slide, and at a point of about plus 15 more or less above mean sea level for the outer limits of the LK slide. The LK slide had a multiple series of slide zones. For the third major slide, Turnagain, the zone of failure appeared to be about plus 5 feet more or less mean sea level. It is reasonably clear that sand layers made quick by the high degree of agitation from seismic shock and clay zones made sensitive by the same forces, either alone or in combination, were actually the slide surfaces on which the mass of earth each earth mass moved. In the graben areas and at the pressure ridges of the toe of slides, much destruction of structures, buried, and surface utilities occurred. In these areas, buildings were either totally destroyed or so wrecked that repair was infeasible. But where the landmass moved out intact, little or no damage from slide effect took place. One quite large masonry-type apartment building, 6 stories in height, actually moved laterally about 9 feet with no or very little damage of any kind to the structure, and even the utility connections and adjacent utility lines moved with the structure itself. Damage from seismic shock to the structural and architectural features of buildings is another subject, and aside from stating that generally those designed with seismic consideration stood up reasonably well in minimizing the damage, this phase of the disaster is not dwelt on in this paper. Another example, somewhat less dramatic, but most interesting in studying the slide, was the cracking pattern of the land mass back of the turn-again slide, in which the outward movement due to slide occurred as a consistent crack increment. In a distance of 1,050 feet, the land actually moved a total of 4 feet. This was ascertained by measurements taken between 2 known market survey markers before and after the slide. Measurement of the crack pattern, which closely summed up to this distance of 4 feet and appeared to be generally regular in width. I'm referring to each crack. As far as could be determined by actual survey check, witness accounts, and from slope indicator readings, the slide stabilized sharply after seismic impulse ceased. Localized earth movements of a consolidation nature did and will continue to occur as the disturbed zones settle. In order to secure as much background information as possible, aerial photography as well as ground surveys were made to provide a steady basis of land movement and crack pattern. Fortunately, there existed aerial photography of the area prior to the quake, which provided a valuable base for comparative studies. Earlier geologic reconnaissance and subsequent surveys since the disturbance and a study of the existing mapping disclosed the remnants of former slides that had occurred, probably long before Anchorage became established as a town, which took place approximately 1913. I suspect that there will be at least one paper presented on the geological aspects of the Anchorage area. Therefore, I will confine my discussion to the soils data as disclosed by the drilling logs on the various deposits encountered and their relation to the slide. Each slide had a mantle of glacial outwash known as Napton deposit, which varied in thickness from a few feet in West Turnagain to as much as 70 feet on Government Hill. This mantle was underlain with a silty clay formation of varying thickness, commonly known as the bootlegger clay deposit, the upper layers of which generally were found to be somewhat stiffer than those at an intermediate depth, and the lower layers of which again acquired a stiffness characteristic. The intermediate layers were generally quite sensitive, although their sensitivity varied with location. In all clay deposits, sand lenses of varying thicknesses were found. These did not always appear to have extensive lateral continuity, as drill holes spaced relatively close failed to disclose the same formation at the same depth. The sensitive clays did reach below mean low-low in much of the area. These clays do not extend under all of the Anchorage area, but generally exist along the coastline and tend to thin out and disappear at a varying distance inland from the shore. While in the specific zones of failure, the clay lost its sensitivity through the remolding process, The clays above and below this zone still retain this property. The study of possible treatments for the slide has had considerable analysis, and it appears by grading, draining, buttressing, the 4th Avenue slide can be economically protected from additional sliding induced by seismic disturbances of no greater intensity than the quake under consideration. A design has been prepared for this work and awaits directive and funding for its construction. Now, the agency, the federal agency that has been responsible for this input is the Alaska State Housing Authority, which is the legal entity in Alaska for the Urban Renewal Organization in Washington. And they have, through their constituted authorities, been able to program this work, and we have worked very closely with that organization in attempting to create a buttress treatment for the 4th Avenue slide. The buttress treatments, if found to be feasible on the Elk area, which to date they have not been found to be that because of a poor benefit-to-cost ratio, the cost of doing this so exceeds the cost of the land that you protect that it just is not an economic thing to do. There appears to be a very good likelihood that the Turnagain area can be buttressed and made safe, and we will be working with the Alaska Housing Authority on this activity very shortly. We are expecting to... The plan chosen in the Turnagain area will require a test section or model to develop the optimum method, which we intend to follow in our stabilization of that slide. As discussed just a moment ago, the LK slide is still under analysis, and as of the date of this paper, there does not appear to be too much of an economic solution possible. There are about 200 homes in this area, as well as some institutional buildings and also a number of apartment-type structures. Their value runs into many millions of dollars, but it appears that the solutions to this slide will also be quite expensive. The Government Hill slide is susceptible, not really one of the real major slides, although it was extensive, is susceptible to treatment without large sums of money involved, and the combination of grading and drainage of the area will accomplish the necessary strengthening. This work has not been programmed so far. Whether a monetarily acceptable solution to the 1st Avenue slide is still not final. As you were told, a very large federal hospital, Native Service Hospital, is in jeopardy in that area, and the slide came very close to badly damaging that structure, and there just has to be a way found as to stabilize that slide. This extensive investigation, testing, and analysis confirms the vulnerability of the bluffs of the coastal region of the Anchorage area, which is underlain by the Bootlegger Clay Foundation, to slide upon agitation by seismic forces. Segments of old slides that occurred in the past and ignored because of the uninhabited previous history of the area again confirm this fact. These present slides, occurring when they did in the relatively early history of the development of the city of Anchorage, while costly in damage and loss of life, do have the importance of alerting the community to the danger. With proper attention given by the administratively responsible bodies to this danger, through precautions taken in strengthening the slopes, codifying and zoning the sensitive regions, will permit the growth of the community to take place in relative safety and preclude far more serious damage from occurring in the future growth period lying ahead, which damage otherwise most surely would occur. Now, I don't know if Dr. Anderson, whether we have time for these slides or not.
I think perhaps we better postpone.
All right. I will be glad to show them at any time that you can make available, or I'm leaving tonight, however.
I have this suggestion. Mr. Frank C. DeLuzio, who was scheduled to give the paper to begin at 1:20 this afternoon, apparently will not be here to present his paper. So perhaps, Mr. George, you would consent to come back at that time and show the 80-some slides that you have on some of the structural damage in the Anchorage area. Thank you very much for your presentation. One further announcement to be made. Perhaps most of you are not aware that we have a number of commercial exhibits which are on display in the entrance foyer above the dining commons. And when you walk back over to the dining commons from the Patty building this morning, you will be able to go through this entrance foyer and see the commercial exhibits. Several of the exhibitors had difficulty getting their materials up here, and displays were set up last evening. So if you are interested why these things are available, and we hope you will go through and talk to some of these people. The next paper, Structural Design Problems Associated with the Alaska Earthquake, is to be presented by William E. Shame. Mr. Shame is Chief of the Structures Branch Office, Chief of Engineers, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, Washington, D.C. Mr. Shame.
I believe that by now each of you must be well aware of the date and the time, the magnitude of the earthquake that crippled South Central Alaska, so I will not go over that ground again. I do want to repeat one thing that I think bears a little emphasis, and that is that the earthquake was greater than the San Francisco earthquake of 1906 and at least equaled the greatest shock of the 1960 Chilean earthquake. What I have to say here today is not so much in review or in history of what has happened, because that has been pretty well covered, and I would guess that probably all of you by now are as familiar with it as I am. What I would like to do is to sow a few seeds of thought for the design that some of you are going to prepare and that some of you are going to buy. In most of the talks so far, we've been relatively dealing with something that the individual, the public, is not too well aware of. It's not something that they can put their hands on. You can feel an earthquake when it happens, but aside from that, you can't particularly feel it. It's not something that everybody lives with every day, but the buildings that you live in, that you buy your clothes in, that you go to school in, are all something that we live with every day, and they are probably what is affected more by the earthquake than anything else that we know. Mr. George pointed out one thing in his talk, and that was that the death toll was not any higher than it was, probably due to the time of day. I would like to expand that just a little bit, pointing out that if this earthquake had occurred at the time when stores, offices, schools were crowded, the death toll would have been much higher than it is. By the same token, if it had occurred later at night, particularly in the military installations, and I suspect in many of the apartment buildings that I saw, when the bunks, beds were occupied,
again, the death toll would have been much higher. Tragic seems to be a trite description of the destruction, but it could have been worse. Almost within hours following the disaster, the stricken areas were invaded by a young army of scientists, engineers, researchers, just plain sightseers. Each was armed with a notebook and at least one camera. Many of them were so loaded down that I don't see how they walked around. And included in this multitude of researchers was a large number of structural engineers trying to seek the causes for the failures and trying to find out why some buildings survived as well as they did. What we as structural engineers actually saw was a wide variation in the application of the art of seismic design and construction. No matter how much we try to divorce the two in our thinking or in our approach to the finished structure, we can't do it. The best designed building, unless properly constructed, is in trouble from the beginning. And conversely, the best construction practices cannot save a faulty design from resulting in a potentially hazardous building. In evaluating the response of the various structures to the Good Friday earthquake, we generally observed that the smaller one- and two-story buildings seemed to perform a lot better than the larger and taller buildings. This observation, of course, does not apply to those buildings that were located directly over or on fissured ground. However, it must be remembered that the smaller structures have a relatively short natural period and that the earthquake was deduced to have had a long period but a relatively low acceleration value. Had Anchorage been situated a good deal closer to the epicenter and these same buildings exposed to the higher frequencies of wave motion, then the damage to the one- and two-story buildings would have been expected to be much higher than it was. Well, let us confine ourselves to the actual observation of damaged structures ranging from relatively minor damage in many of these structures in Anchorage to total destruction that we saw in the Four Seasons apartment building. And very fortunately, the latter was not yet occupied. It was within, I understand, 30 days of being completed. A very brief review of the damaged structures in the Anchorage area quickly reveals two general problem areas. One, basic design. Two, construction practices. In the category of design problems, there are several examples which I believe merit consideration. One, severe damage was suffered by and because of improperly designed and or constructed masonry walls. There are frequent cases of unreinforced masonry walls which were intended by the designer to be only filler panels. Therefore, they ignored them in the design. Unfortunately, these walls didn't know that they weren't intended to act as shear walls, and the result was that they broke up rather badly. Some of them, I think, actually practically exploded. Connections between various building elements were frequently ineffective. Diaphragm connections to shear walls were often inadequate. In one case, a steel bracing stopped short of shear walls by one complete purlin spacing. We frequently observed that vertical resisting elements, that is, properly designed shear walls, were provided on only one side of a seismic joint. On the other side of the same joint, only an unreinforced masonry wall was used. And that wall was incapable of serving as a vertical resisting element for the adjacent portion of the building. In another case, shear walls were ignored and bypassed by steel bracing. There were cases of solid shear walls of masonry or tilled up concrete encased or surrounded by small concrete frames. Well, these frames had sheared off through diagonal compression of the interior walls. And this raises a question as far as the design people are concerned as to whether maybe we don't have to go back and review some of the design principles in that particular area. I think maybe we need to raise the coefficients that we use for that type of frame. Considerable damage was suffered by short, stiff spandrels connecting pairs of relatively tall, slender shear walls. We saw a number of instances where these spandrels had been pierced by heating ducts or pipe chases at both, further weakening them. This condition again indicates that some review of the basic concept of seismic design may be required. Thick concrete slabs bend. I think that the deflection of these slabs needs additional study. In the West High School in Anchorage, there is evidence that the roof slabs and the second floor slabs vibrated at different frequencies or at least out of phase. Connections between precast concrete members necessary to the creation of a homogeneous system or a mechanism needs further study and probably some large-scale tests. There are many failures of this type of welded insert type of connection. Leaving the area of design and going into construction practices, we noted a number of things such as poor cleaning of construction joints so that the resulting joint acted almost as a perfect shear plane. Reinforcing bar laps were often too short. Cells in what were supposed to be reinforced masonry walls had not been filled. Frequently we found where the vertical bars in there were just loose in the cells. The column ties have been omitted in a number of critical areas. Cross bracing was frequently only tack welded. Connections did not develop the strength of the member. I might point out that in one place I saw an inch and a half bar, which was used as a cross bracing with a turnbuckle on it, that had three little tack weld spots on it. Surprising it even held up its own weight. Well, these are but a few of the problems. We call them deficiencies, if you will, and there can be no doubt that a complete damage inventory of every building would reveal a list many times longer than the examples just given. I have lists many times this long. In all fairness to the designers, some of the design problems are in what we might call gray areas where we're really not too sure of ourselves. As far as construction deficiencies are concerned, they are a little different than can be observed every day in the lower 48. I do not say that this excuses them. I do not think they are forgivable either here or in the lower 48, but particularly they are not excusable where there is a remote chance of seismic activity. Earthquakes are as old as the world itself, but our records are only a very comparatively recent and even then are incomplete. For instance, in the many talks that you have heard concerning the time, duration, and so forth, nobody has said yet how long this earthquake lasted. We don't know what the duration of it is. I've seen all sorts of figures on it. On the basis of some 35 years of records, we have developed a generally accepted code for design of earthquake-resistant structures. Even this code, the Uniform Building Code, as adopted by the International Conference of Building Officials, is not based on maximum possible earthquake, nor does it guarantee total prevention of damage. What it is intended to do is to minimize damage and to prevent structural collapse. Generally, the structural profession has progressed to a point where on almost any given set of foundation conditions, we could design a structure of normal size and configuration that would probably ride out even a shock somewhat greater than that of March 27th without any damage. But the design problems that would be involved in that would result in the cost of a building that nobody could afford, not even Uncle Sam. The answer then must be somewhere between total ignorance of seismic possibility and total accommodation of seismic forces. The present building code as it stands today, while certainly not perfect and empirical in many respects, is the best guide that we have to follow for structural design. However, interpretation is largely left up to the individual designer and appears that in many cases the real response to the structures just wasn't understood, or worse yet, I don't know whether it's any worse or equally bad, the designs were not carried through. Horizontal bracing systems, as I pointed out before, didn't carry through to their natural reactions. Shear walls abutting horizontal diaphragms were completely ignored in many cases. There is strong evidence that all too frequently the structural engineer is guided or coerced into acceptance of something less than sound design by glowing innovations in component systems, and even by so-called advanced architectural creations. Certainly man's achievements are limited only by his imagination, but the structural designer should not, especially in seismic areas, accept unproven or questionable concepts. The proving ground must not be permitted to the actual use in seismic prone areas. I might point out at this particular point that I'm speaking really as an individual. However, I am chief of the structures branch, and in that branch I have two main sections. One is structural, one is architectural. My office is right in between the two rooms. The architects come running into me and they say, "The darn fool structural engineers want to put a beam right through my window." The structural engineers come running in and say, "They want to put a window right in the middle of my beam." They call me Dr. Kook sometimes. But here's where a big problem is. In his quest for producing for his client a structure with the ultimate in space and functional planning, the architect so frequently fails, unintentionally or otherwise, to provide for lateral stability. The structural engineer is then expected to find a way to make the structure stable. I've talked with many structural engineers in the last few months, and I join with them in the opinion that in seismic areas it should be considered good design to have a building look like it is laterally stable. What then is the structural engineer's role in the design of structures in earthquake-prone regions? Does it start with a footing placed on a foundation handed over by someone else, include a frame designed to accommodate the whim of someone else, ignore the installation of equipment by others, bend to the dictates of dollars, and end with delivering a set of structural plans and calculations? Well, this obviously isn't true. I think every architect and engineer is basically conscientious. Yet it does appear that if you go through the various buildings, that all too frequently these are exactly the things that happen. One of the big problems facing the structural engineer is a problem confronting many urban areas today. He is asked to provide a design for a structure to be located on marginal or worse land. The behavior of soils under dynamic loads such as caused by earthquakes is not completely understood and does need more study. Until we have more complete knowledge of soils mechanics under such conditions, we must be more conservative. Soils investigations are expensive and more often neglected than otherwise. I've been in this business for a number of years, and one of the biggest problems is getting adequate soils investigations. Frequently known and published geological soils conditions are ignored or passed over in design simply because the client has a plot of ground and intends to build. It seems logical that the competent structural engineer should take advantage of all available information, and if there is a shadow of a doubt, he should insist on additional exploration for his as well as his client's protection, but most of all for the protection of the public. Furthermore, in the areas of unstable or marginal geological and soils conditions, municipalities must establish zoning regulations to positively regulate construction in areas near artificial or natural slopes, and regulations on the height and or slope angle of such slopes. This was pointed out previously by Mr. George and also by Mr. Dobervall. As stated previously, if the foundation conditions are known, we can design and build a reasonably safe structure if someone is willing to pay the price. But like the fire prevention engineer and the safety engineer, the structural engineer needs to recognize his responsibility for the safety of human life in the building he designs and must not be a party to overlooking unsafe conditions. By the same token, I think there is just as much of a responsibility on the part of people that intend to build buildings which will be occupied by the public either infrequently or continually to consider the consequences of insisting that a building be built in an unsafe area. And this is done every day. Even with full recognition of true foundation conditions, the structural engineer must train himself to follow through on each component part and every detail of connection. In those features of design where there's a shadow of a doubt, conservatism rather than optimism should prevail. The structural engineer's responsibility shouldn't be expected or permitted to end with the completion of design. So flagrant were some of the construction deficiencies that it is apparent that the services of a competent engineer or even structurally trained inspector was not employed on all construction. Seems to me to be prudent. The structural engineer should be called upon for inspection during construction just as the architect is called upon to ensure his phase of the work. This admittedly will add more cost. We already have a spiraling economy, but I doubt very seriously if we can afford to do otherwise, particularly where human life is at stake. Although not basically structural, one of the glaring problems that come out of this Alaska earthquake is in the field of utilities. Now, utilities in the broadest sense, ranging from the innocent-looking suspended light fixtures to electric, water, steam lines crossing seismic joints in buildings, and also buried utility systems. Here we find that the codes are silent in regard to the design of mechanical and electrical systems, with the exception of sprinkler systems. In Anchorage, only a miracle saved several large steam plants from blowing up in the Anchorage area. The shells of the plants were designed according to the seismic codes and performed very beautifully. But in the equipment inside the buildings, there was a complete or almost complete disregard for seismic considerations, and the damage was terrific. In many of the public buildings that I went into, I found elevated motors